Welcome to the Social Podcast, where no discussion or debate is off limits.
Hello and welcome to this week's All Talk edition of The Social. Melissa and Jess will be here a little later. Joining us now is sports journalist Shireen Ahmed. Welcome back to the show, Shireen.
Hello.
We're delighted to have you back. And we're also delighted to welcome from Toronto travel and lifestyle expert, Natalie Preddy. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm pumped to be here.
We're so pumped to have both of you. And we're going to get started because we have a lot to talk about. First, could you work a job you didn't enjoy? In a recent press conference, tennis star Nick Kyrgios said the sport wasn't his first love and eventually he would like to do something else. Do you have to like or love your job, Shireen?
Nick Kyrgios is like an amazing character in tennis, and one of the things that he's arguably the bad boy, but he also doesn't take tennis too seriously. And in a year where we've had a lot of conversations about athletes being more than just athletes, they're humans, and we tend to forget that, like the comments Naomi Osaka made about mental health, I actually really like the fact that he admits that there's aspects of his job that's not all glamorous. Could I personally do a job that I don't like? I'm a single mother of four, so the answer is obviously yes. But I mean, I actually love what I do, but yes, I would absolutely do something even if I didn't love it, if I needed to.
I love that you said that, Shireen, about like Nick Kyrgios's place in tennis, because his bad boy status of course gets him into trouble sometimes, but also he exposes what a lot of people don't talk about, which is the downside of success. You know, in order to become a Roger Federer, in order to become a Rafael Nadal, which, you know, he has the potential to be, Nick Kyrgios, you have to sacrifice a lot. Like, all you ever do is practice, train, ice bath, travel, practice, train, ice bath, travel. I mean, that's the life. And he's 26 years old. He's been at this since a teenager. And sometimes I think success turns society into hypocrites, because out of one side of our mouths, we encourage kids to find themselves, to have balance in their lives, to go out and experience things. Then an athlete is successful and sacrifices all those experiences, meeting up with friends, having girlfriends and boyfriends, you know, going to school, doing other things. And suddenly you're like, yeah, those sacrifices are worth it. Don't have a real life. Don't have a balanced life. But, you know, just win these trophies. So I like that he's like, yeah, I'm good at this thing, but I don't have to be great. I'm still making a lot of money and I can give it up anytime.
I completely agree. I think that you have to have balance. And I love that as a celebrity and as a sports figure, he is saying that, because, you know, a lot of people, and I'd say 90% of society works in jobs that they don't love because, you know, for necessity, you know, because you are a single parent or for your family, maybe you're the breadwinner, maybe, you know, you've recently lost a stroke, whatever that may be. I feel like those of us, and I'm luckily get to count myself among those people who gets to do what they love, a lot of people don't have that opportunity. But saying that, even if you get to do something you love, like myself, there are always aspects of your job that you don't love. And I feel like that's okay. That's life. I mean, there are things that you're going to love about life. There are things that you're not going to love about life. Not all of it is glamorous. Not all of it's pretty. There are a lot more ice baths than you ever want. But you know, exactly. I think balance, and especially over the pandemic, we have really seen that mental health and physical health and emotional health is just as important. And for success, we really do need to have that balance.
Yes. I mean, I'm sitting here listening to all of you and you're raising really good points, but I'm just thinking of my own story, which is that like when I was in high school, I decided, okay, I'm exploring universities. I'm going to choose to go into film and television because I just loved film and television. I didn't really know what was happening. So my major was in screenwriting initially because I was, you know, I thought a fairly strong writer. But as I started to get into my second and third year, I did have this realization where I was surrounded by people who loved film with a capital L. And they loved writing. And it dawned on me that I did not love it enough, because I recognized that in order to even have a shot in Canada, first of all, and then just in general with this very, very competitive industry, I was going to have to sacrifice a lot. I was going to have to sort of eat, drink, sleep, writing and screenwriting. And I was just like, I have to figure out what it is about this craft that I like, and maybe I can find a different way. Ultimately, it was like, I need to tell stories, and there are many different ways to do that. Having said that, I just will just end with this idea. I think a lot of times we encourage, especially young people, you have to find something that you love and make that your career choice. And I do think that's important to find your passion and your pleasure in life. But at the same time, I wonder if some people would be happier choosing jobs that are, if you can find a job that was not stressful, that had good benefits, a good salary, that's non-toxic, and then you got to pursue your passion on the side, I wonder if that's sometimes a better option than pursuing something that's highly stressful that you love.
I mean, one of the things that I think is really important about what Nick Kyrgios said was also that he loves tennis. It's true, but it's not everything for him. And for me, that was incredibly compelling. Like, your job doesn't have to identify and be only who you are. There can be different elements. And I think that when society looked around and heard him say that, they're like, because there's a certain amount within the realm of sports that spectators and fans feel entitled to you. And he's like, no. There's more to me than just this, and that's something that I definitely appreciated.
I like that point too, Shireen, especially since with athletics, it's a job you only get to do for a finite amount of time. Like, Cynthia, you were talking about screenwriting, and I get it, right? Like, you know, that wasn't your passion, but you could, if that was, you could have done it until you die. Because, you know, anybody, but no one can play tennis till they're 90. Like, you can't competitively, right? And so for athletes in particular, we have seen a lot of them peak or whatever, and then they're 30, which is young, and they're like, what now? I don't know anyone. I don't know anything outside of the sport. I don't know how to do anything. I have no other skills. I'm not that interesting because, again, practice, training, ice bath. Like, so... I think Nick Kyrgios might be onto something.
Okay, we're going to switch gears now. So here's a question. Should you be honest with your partner about their looks? A husband asked for advice on Reddit saying his wife got upset when he said he preferred her previous hairstyle to the current one. So, Natalie, do you think it's okay? Would you be honest, or do you appreciate honesty from your partner if they maybe take issue with some of your appearance?
So, you know what? I read through that whole Reddit feed, and I think in this particular instance for this woman, it was a very, there was a whole story behind it. So one of her friends had recently gotten divorced and her husband had left her for a younger model. And so I feel like her insecurities had come out in this change of hairstyle and her need for her husband's approval. I feel like everyone is different. Everyone is different. You know what your partner wants and needs to hear. You also know what you should and shouldn't say. So my husband and I have a thing that if you can't change it in 5 minutes, you don't talk about it at that point. That's something we can address later, right? So, you know, if I'm wearing a dress and I say, how does this look? Or do I look fat in this? He would say, oh, I like the red dress, but not because it makes you look fatter, because I can't change that in 5 minutes, but I can change the dress. Hairstyle, also hair can grow back. You can dye it a different color. So, but again, not in 5 minutes if you're on the way out the door. So I think there is a level of honesty. And then you can dive deeper, maybe when you're not heading out the door, and definitely not after a few drinks as well. Just leave that one alone. Leave that one well alone. But,
Shireen,
you know,
do you have an opinion about this, Shireen?
I think that when I read that thing, I had a lot of questions. There was a journalist in me that was like, no, this man is too nice. There's something happening here. I'm a little suspicious about the support level. But also, really, it's like, who doesn't lie to their partner a little bit? I mean, arguably, there's been times where you know, you don't want to hurt someone's feelings. And as much as I believe in honesty and transparency in relationships, like, yeah, honey, you look great. Because, I mean, we're still, like, I'm in my 40s. I still think about this and ask these questions because society has programmed us to. So I'm okay with a little bit of a white lie. If I come home, I get my hair done, or I'm like, kids, how do I look? They're like, I've trained them to be, like, amazing. You are fabulous. You are a fashion goddess. There's nobody more beautiful than you. You are a walking, talking thirst trap. So, you know, this is what I want to hear. Truthfully, it's what we I want to hear, and I deserve to.
Our viewers are definitely feeling this story. Linda on Facebook tells us that they think that comment is honest, and I don't find it hurtful. First time I had my hair cut after I started dating my now husband, his comment was, "It's bloody awful." And I still married him. And that was 44 years ago, which I guess, Linda, and I think, Linda, I think you and I might have a similar marriage. Yasik and I have no like white lies with each other when it comes to appearance. He feels free to tell me his bad taste comments on my appearance, which I never take. I don't take seriously and I never change. And I freely tell him when he looks like a slob, when I wish he had better style, he should do this with his hair. He should. And he has clearly ignored me all these years to his own detriment, by the way. So it depends on the relationship. That just happens to be our relationship.
I mean, it depends on the relationship, and maybe we're saying the same thing, or does it depend on if you trust their sense of style? And maybe those things are overlapping in the Venn diagram, especially in your case, Lainey. But I mean, Jason, I do trust, like in some cases, he's a director of photography. He works with like actors and things like that. So I remember, he knows a thing or two about like lighting and makeup. So I remember early on in my career, I started out, I was just doing a test shoot, and I had come out of getting my makeup professionally done, and I got in the car and he goes, No. We have to go to a makeup counter right now. You need to fix this. And I was at first really crushed, but then I was like, I looked at myself in the mirror and I was like, yeah, it's a disaster. So sometimes it's the right time, right place, and it's worth the 5 minutes to fix.
Should workplaces make different demands of parents, single parents, and non-parents? An article in Fast Company says organizations should not expect that all parents have support systems at home. So the question is, should workplaces treat people differently based on their home lives? What do you think?
I mean, one of the things is that if you're an employer and you have staff, they have different needs. I don't think there's anything wrong in recognizing or accommodating for different parents. I'm a single parent. And, you know, for a really long time, if I needed an extension or if I needed a deadline, because as somebody who files on a specific deadline, I never wanted to extend. But my son caught COVID in December. He actually had COVID and he was 14 at the time. And then I was like, I think I need another day. And me being transparent with my boss and saying, I need a couple days more to deal with this, you know, was important. So not everyone's situation. And actually over the period of COVID, we've seen the amount of emotional and physical and mental labor that women have had to take up at home. We know this. And so that plays a factor into it as well. And I think it would be beneficial for a workplace to take that into account when they're dealing with parents. Could be a single dad too, but not everybody's circumstances the same.
Well, I've seen over COVID, and as you said, we have seen that so many people have lots and lots of different backgrounds and you know, different type of support that they're giving their family. One of my good friends is a VP in wealth management. And throughout quarantine, she found that, you know, a lot of the other people on her level, again, all men, were, you know, their kids, they had nannies, or they had a partner that was managing the kids, or they had older children. And she had kids that were school age, you know, 7 and 4, and she had to help with virtual school. And I mean, luckily she had a partner who was very helpful, but the expectations for her were still these long, long hours. The fact that they were, you know, they expected all of these, you know, these deadlines for her and these long hours, which she was just not able to give. She did it. She managed to do it. But at, you know, at what cost? So I think that, you know, all employers, whether it's childcare or grievance counseling or, you know, whatever sort of support that employees need, they should be offering that. And then how people take them and how people use them, you know, is up to them, because, you know, someone may be a caregiver, someone, you know, may be a single parent, and we don't know what resources we need. We don't need to look into everyone's personal life, but just having these resources available is very helpful.
And having the conversation too, Natalie, I think you're pointing that out. And Alexander on Facebook said, when I was single, my boss always assumed I would stay late when needed because, quote, you don't have kids. That really sucked. Now I'm a mother and I totally understand the struggle to maintain work and home, but it can't be defaulted to the childless worker either. And Alexander, I think that's a really good point. And that is why, as Natalie, you were saying, you kind of can't have this one size fits all kind of model. And I think the pandemic has shown us there are all kinds of reasons why someone might need extra time. It could be mental health reasons. They could be looking after an elderly parent. They could have a sick child. There's so many different situations. And, you know, conversely, a single parent could have, let's say, a live-in, you know, family member who is able to help out. So you just don't know. And I did. So there's no one-size-fits-all model. The thing that I'm getting increasingly worried about is that all these discussions that seemed to be having around the, dissolving of this 9-to-5 system where you have to be in the office, and people were questioning this, and it seemed like we were about to re-enter society with a whole new framework for workplaces. What I'm hearing from my friends is that increasingly that's starting to disappear, and that the expectation is going back to status quo. And I think that we need to have more conversations about why that's not going to work. You know what I mean, Lainey?
I know what you mean. I'm not sure, there are going to be differing opinions on this, obviously. And we have one from Amy on Facebook. And Amy says, it's not the job of the company to cater to you and your family. They have enough to do than take care of everyone's personal life. You accepted the job. You knew what you were taking on. It's your responsibility, not others. In the words of Clueless Amy, way harsh. I do think that Amy, we appreciate that, because I think Amy represents a lot of people's attitude about what the workplace is responsible for and what you as an employee are responsible for. And I think that comes from the fact that even the way that workplaces have been set up is like an archaic system. Like, we've all been conditioned by it. You know, we've all been conditioned to be like, you go and you show up, you punch in at 8 o'clock, you have to stay till 5 o'clock. You should only take a half an hour break, you know? And I think that point is, Cynthia, a lot of people are pushing back against this conditioning, against this system that hasn't evolved since, like, I don't know, the Second World War, right? Yep. Literally, like, that's when it was established. And so it's really time. Like, I don't think this is enough. I think the entire workplace structure and how work looks for people has to be reexamined and reimagined. Even though I disagree with, Amy might disagree with me.
Okay, we're gonna switch gears to a totally different landscape and ask this question. How much tongue is too much? We're asking this because Kourtney Kardashian and Travis Barker, they were attracting some attention online for the way that they made out at the UFC match. Oh, what are your thoughts? Is that a kiss? I don't even know if that could be called a kiss. Yeah, go.
I think, Cynthia, when you said attracting attention, I think that was the key phrase. That's exactly what they were doing there. I feel like Kris Jenner is sitting at home and she has like a big calendar. She has each child in a row. And she's like, Kourtney is going to lick Travis today. Make sure Cameron's there. Kim is going to do blank. I feel like every part of their life is choreographed. That lick was gross. It was too much. Don't need to see it. But actually, I had a friend say yesterday, the Kardashians, which I thought was really, really funny. I feel like they, you know, it just makes sense for them to do something gross like that. I think they were licking fingers too at one point, which especially during COVID is just disgusting. You don't know where those hands have been.
That is true.
Yeah, I totally wasn't bothered by this. I think Travis Barker and, like, you know, Kourtney Kardashian, I'm like, whatever. It doesn't bother me. I'm like, are we asking this question though from a technical standpoint? Is that what's happening? Like, am I going to sit back and like judge the kiss? I'm like, you know what? They love the kiss cam. People that want to do it, do it. I just think that it was really interesting because, like, to Natalie's point, this is what they do. Travis Barker is a performer and she's in entertainment. Khloe Kardashian's and Kourtney Kardashian's are in entertainment. This is what they do. For me, I'm like, you know what? This is funny. This is something for me to put in a WhatsApp group chat.
I hear what you're saying, but not all entertainers are like shoving their tongues into the mouth of somebody else in the front row. Like, there are thousands of entertainers. We're not seeing it. It's these specific people. And I have to say, when I saw it, I was like, yeah, I'm into this. It tracks. Because for sure, Travis Barker is the type, you know, white guy tattoos, kind of punky. Those guys always do the tongue outside the mouth thing. Axl Rose, Tommy Lee, Machine Gun Kelly, the guy from Whitesnake, every big hair band from the 80s. In the 80s, we were inundated with outside of the mouth tongue kisses in music videos. That was Steven our
Tyler,
norm.
100%.
That was our 100%. Norm. And then in the 90s and the 2000s, people put their tongues back in their mouth. And I feel like Travis and Kourtney are taking their tongues back out. And it may be time for the tongue to have a resurgence in kissing. I don't
not
know.
Like that.
I debate
whether or not that was a kiss at all. Like, I really do think that was licking. I think Natalie had it right. And I do think that there are some really bad kisses that take place with tongue, with a closed mouth. I think you have to be really careful when it comes to doing tongue at all. And I think you have to kind of, there's an art to it. And it surprises me how many people get it wrong. Like, I remember a guy who was,
one person's art is another person's trash and vice versa. Like, you and I might not be down with the all over tongue, all over the face thing, but there are some people who want to be kissed like that because I've seen it.
Fair enough. Fair enough. We have to leave that there. Shireen and Natalie, it was such a pleasure having you with us. Thanks so much for being here.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for sticking around. Jess Allen and I here for the continuation of the All Talk edition of The Social. Hey, listen, live from New York, we are welcoming our next guest, the dynamic duo behind the Slate podcast. In case you missed it, Rachel Hampton and Madison Malone Kircher. Ladies, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
We're very excited. We're going to go right into it. Because guys, TikTok has launched a platform that allows viewers to apply for jobs at participating companies with a short video rather than like that traditional resume. So what do you think? Is this the future of the job hunt? Rachel, what do you think?
I mean, I really think it's kind of a continuation. We've seen kind of viral campaigns from younger people applying to jobs in this new way of applying by video. So the fact that TikTok is formalizing it, I think is pretty cool. I think it really kind of taps into what Gen Z is good at. I guess I am kind of curious as to, for marketing campaigns, if people might apply on TikTok and see their marketing campaign 5 months later without getting a job, you know?
Oh, that's true. That's true.
That's dark,
Madison,
Rachel.
What about you?
It's interesting. In 2016, way, way back in the past, I distinctly remember a college student creating a Snapchat geo filter. He paid like $30 to have the filter over the building of the company where he wanted to work. So if you used Snapchat that day at that company, you'd see, hire me, so-and-so's name, contact info. This just feels like a logical extension of like the creativity of Gen Z.
Yeah, but can I ask a really serious question? Because you can shoot, maybe write, maybe light yourself well and then edit well. Is this the skill set for every single headhunter, recruiter out there? Like, that's a very specific skill set to be really good at social media stuff. But does that apply to every career or industry?
Not every career, Mel, but I think at Gen Z, I'm Canadian, so I'm calling it Gen Z rather than Gen Z. Shout out to the Z. But I have to say for that age group, like 25, you know, years old, it's not just so much in how you're shooting, but it's what you're shooting. I think this is fantastic and that you could showcase a lot within the actual content, your personality, your communication skills, how good you are with numbers, with other people, instead of like what I grew up with, which was that, you know, 8.5 by 11 piece of white paper where the most exciting thing was choosing the font. Oh my God, is it going to be Helvetica or A.
Don't choose wrong.
I don't even know.
Yeah.
Exactly.
This is true. But as somebody who has gone through those 8.5 by 11s, we know that there's like, how do you capture a human
on a piece of paper. Like, you really can't. And, you know, with my family's business, I have gone through literally thousands of resumes. And I cannot tell you, first of all, how impossible it is to try to get a gauge on somebody until I get them on the phone or maybe in person or these days a Zoom. But to be very, very honest, yeah, those are definitely shortcomings. But it was never, I can't tell you, there's zero correlation between what I see sometimes on those pieces of paper and then what that person ends up being like IRL, which again brings me back to TikTok. Because until you can sit or talk to someone IRL in real life, for my mother, do you actually ever know what someone's really like?
I mean, I guess in a way it's kind of just giving the interview portion first, because I mean, if you think about your first interview with a company, are you ever truly yourself? I don't think I've ever really been pure, unfiltered Rachel in a job interview. I saved that for like month four when you can't fire me anymore. So you're kind of you're kind of just putting the interview first in a way. I'm assuming that with the TikTok resumes, at some point, the traditional 8x11 is going to be introduced into the process at some point. I think it is a way to get a feel for somebody, and then they reach out, and then you can go through the usual process. But it's right. kind of a get around to the cover letter, which is the worst part of jobs.
No kidding. That yeah. language.
I want to flip it, though, because I was going through the TikTok resumes because I was like, what's going on there? And I found two things. Number one, for some people, their resume, they made it look like a dating profile. I would not recommend that.
No.
I don't need to see you in certain outfits, but depending on the job, I guess, you're applying for. But secondly, I actually saw a really wicked one from a potential employer. It was none other than Big Sean, and he was recruiting. He's actually looking for creative director in a project he's going to be doing with the Detroit Pistons soon. And he's like, send me your resume. And I was like, see, this is how it works. Because if you want to recruit young, hot, good editors, you know, like on the cutting edge of creativity, I was like, yes, Big Sean. So I think the opposite might work better, where you've got somebody who's like, I need the young, the hot, the creative, like at my fingertips. Beautiful. It was beautiful. Listen, I do want to stick with TV and social media and all those things, because reality TV, I mean, there's a writer who wrote for a website called Lexology, and this writer is arguing, ladies and gentlemen, that these shows are providing a much needed escapism during this pandemic. But I got to say, like, we know that there's an appeal to reality TV, but there's still so much snobbery, if I may say, that people who watch prestige TV, I think that reality TV is somehow some lowly cousin. I mean, where do we stand on the role of reality TV today? And are we going to get over this stigma?
We stand firmly in defense of reality TV. I think it's a cheap argument at this point to say that reality TV is lowbrow and to be snobby about it, because frankly, it makes you sound less than bright. There's a lot going on in reality TV. And if you can't acknowledge that and see the storylines that are frankly Shakespearean, maybe you read some Shakespeare.
Madison, I totally agree. I would actually even go a step further and say that, for example, the current season of Real Housewives of New York, it's almost providing like an anthropological record for the time in which we live. Like, we are seeing white women deal with white fragility, with white privilege, and their new black real housewife having to deal with that real struggle. It's absolutely, it's mind-blowing. I get so much, not only entertainment, but, and pleasure, but it makes you kind of, it's like a real window into what's going on in the world right now. Good, bad, and the ugly.
Absolutely. And I think another cheap argument that gets thrown around a lot with reality TV, and you brought up women, is sexist. And to those people, I just say, how many of you are still watching professional wrestling? If you can enjoy a scripted TV show where men smack each other around, you can watch this show about women who are nine steps ahead of you in every thought they make.
Yes. Rachel, can I ask a controversial question, or maybe make a controversial statement and get your reaction? Like, reality TV, as we know, the genre that I think a lot of people think of when you think of reality TV, like Housewives, Kardashians, whatever, isn't sports the exact same thing? It's all just for entertainment.
I would agree with that. I don't think it's that controversial, except I would say that reality television is perhaps, I mean, you mentioned an anthropological study. I would say you can get more out of watching an older episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians in like 2008 than you would from watching a Chicago Bears game from 2008, just because it does really signal what society was talking about at the moment. I think prestige television in some way is what we want to think of ourselves at a specific time period, and reality television is what we actually are. And so
write that down. That's good.
It's really good. I was just thinking the same thing.
Write that down. I will make an admission, because it feels good on a national show when, you know, Jess and I on the regular and our other co-hosts, we just share our deepest, darkest secrets. And I was shamed relentlessly because I was slash am a hardcore Jersey Shore fan and Jersey Shore Family Vacation fan and Laguna Beach and The Hills and all the iterations of those shows thereafter. I even traveled to Miami after Jersey Shore Takes Miami season and did all the same things like maybe Snooki did. And yeah, guess what? Judge me. Judge me. Because I was so deep in my job as a news reporter, I just needed a little GTL. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's all I needed. You know, go ahead and Google, because that show's already really old.
Is mixing business and friendship a recipe for disaster? A woman wrote to ask Amy for help, saying she fired her friend from being her realtor, and now the friendship is off the market. So what are your rules about mixing friendship and business?
Generally, don't do it, right? What's the saying? The quickest way to make an enemy out of a friend is to go into business with them.
Ooh.
It just generally does not go well. And I know of a story of something similar where someone had started and reached out to a friend who was a real estate agent, and they kind of started the process together. And then the first person actually ended up going with a very different real estate agent and making a purchase, and things not only were broken, I don't know if they'll ever get repaired. And they both had their valid reasons, I suppose. But this is one of those cases where almost the closer you are, the warning is do not go into business with one another. It sounds amazing. Like, nobody knows me better. I can trust this person. It sounds like in this story that we're talking about, though, maybe experience was lacking. And I think if anybody's done any real estate, whether you're renting, looking to buy, experience can really make the difference between a sale happening and not happening. And so someone who perhaps just got their license, which is great, everyone's got to start somewhere, but maybe the onus is on you as the real estate agent to be like, you know, I need to take this seriously. And maybe practicing on your friends is not the best way to get your experience, if I can make it go that way. My husband's a contractor, you know, and listen, everybody is always saying to me, I need to do some rentals on my house. Can your husband do it? Ryan has almost like a 100% no policy, with very few exceptions, because he always says it's never worked out, okay? Turns out that I'm not the only one who thinks this way, because Gina on Facebook, she wrote to us right away, and she has a very, very clear message about this, and she says, never do business with friends, not anything big. If you become friends after you do business, it's a bit different. Where do you ladies stand on this?
I mean, it's actually pretty funny. This is exactly the way that me and Madison's friendship has progressed. We were not friends before we did this podcast. Like, I don't even think we followed each other on Twitter,
nope.
Which is our origin story. But I do think that, I mean, it's kind of like living with your friends. Sometimes your best bet for a roommate situation is just living with someone you don't know, because living with your friends can, like, just completely ruin a relationship. And then you talk, it's the element of adding money into it that...
Yes.
One of my mom's biggest pieces of advice to me was just to never mix money into your friendship. Never, like, just don't do it, because it's going to mess it up.
I'd want to know what your mom would think about this, though, because with the realtor situation, I don't mix friendship and business, but with the realtor situation, if you go with your friend who's the realtor, you're essentially handing them over that 2% commission. You're saying, like, imagine if your best friend came to you and said, and you had the opportunity to give them in this market, 10,000, 20,000, if you guys in New York, geez, probably $50,000, $60,000.
But maybe it's the exchange, right? Like, the exchange is supposed to be you get part of this commission, but the exchange is all of your experience and you getting me what I want and need. And can you get that if maybe you're new? I don't know. Maybe.
I don't know. I think I would hope that a dear friend of mine wouldn't use me as a human guinea pig.
Yes, there's that too, right? There's that. If it's a true friendship, you're hoping that your friend would not do that in the first place.
It's a great point. It's a great point. Okay, so we're going to go from housing to another necessity, food. There is a major food fight that has been breaking out online. It's about fish and chip pizza. Someone tweeted that this pizza, I think it was coming out of Japan, is an insult to both England and Italy post-Euro Cup. Anybody? Takers?
Well, listen, I mean, I love fish and chips. I love pizza. I've had potato on pizza, very classic version. Usually it's a Bianco pizza, white pizza with no tomato sauce. Had anchovies. I know this is a little different. Anchovies is one thing. This is like a white fish with cheese on it, which is, you know, Italians are always a little fussy about that kind of business. But I'd hesitantly go in like with a scowl, probably like, I don't know. And I'd probably be like, oh my God, this is so good.
I'm willing to give it a try. The only line I draw on pizza is when you start topping it with like spaghetti or macaroni and cheese, when there's an entire other like carbohydrate based dish atop my pizza, that's when I'm out.
That's two for one.
It's too much.
I don't know. I thought we were all friends. I don't believe, even with anchovies, and I'm sorry if you like anchovies, I do not believe that seafood of any kind belongs on a pizza. The other thing I don't think belongs on a pizza is chocolate. I don't think that belongs on a pizza. A crepe, that's something different. I also don't believe that egg in different
forms. You have to try an egg
on a pizza.
We used to do that. I worked at a pizzeria. And we used to do a breakfast pizza with an egg, sunny side up egg, and they'd put it in the oven, and then you use the crust, Mel, think about it, use the crust to dunk into the egg yolk. Sublime.
Just get toast.
Okay. We're moving on. The Backstreet Boys have announced they'll be performing a series of Christmas concerts in Las Vegas later this year. So who else would you want to see do a Christmas-themed show?
Ooh.
Oh, Carly Rae Jepsen.
Rachel?
She already has an album.
Oh!
Yeah. I answered before you could. Yeah. But she has a banger of a Christmas album, so she's already prepared. I know she knows how to put on a show. Carly Rae Jepsen.
Yes. Wow! That I did not expect. She's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Hear me out. Okay. Lord Spooky Christmas.
Oh,
I'm into that.
Yeah, like a little Nightmare really Before Christmas it. Energy, a little spooky, little holiday.
Yes, I'm down. Jess, I'm dying to hear you.
Well, guys, I missed the boy band sort of thing, and I sort of took this as being like a boy band choice. I just wasn't around for it, too young or too old. So I went with, what about the cast of season 10 of Drag Race? That would be incredible.
Christmas drag show.
Take my money.
Yes.
Take it.
Yes. Living for this. I have too many. And as perhaps, Jess, you know, this is not a surprise. Almost all of my favorite artists have already had a residency in Vegas, and I've seen as many as I can. Like the Britneys, the Mariahs, the J-Los, the Janets. So, you know, if I'm going to go that way, obviously New Kids on the Block, because that was my boy band. So let's step it up, NKOTB. But, you know, there's the classics, a Michael Bublé Christmas in Vegas. That's a sellout. Mm-hmm. Boom. Like easy breezy. That's a sellout. But then you've got the others. I would love to see a Drake Christmas show. How about a Justin Bieber Christmas show? How about a Lady Gaga? It's kind of that Lord feel, because she wouldn't do a traditional Christmas. It would just be like a Gaga monster Christmas also. So, or they could all just get together and do it together. There it is. Hey, Rachel and Madison, we said it off the top of the show. You are the hosts of the podcast, in case you missed it. This delves into all things that are happening on the internet culture. And I feel like, listen, it is a full-time job to keep up with what the heck is happening online. So how does your show, Madison, you can take this one. How does your show help us all in that department?
It is a full-time full-time job, mine, not yours. I don't want it to be your full-time job. Neither does Rachel, or we'll be out of a job. We often joke when we're prepping for shows like that the tagline for us is that we're online so you don't have to be. So the ideal listener to our show is somebody who vaguely wants to know about what's going on online, but has no idea why people are shouting about feral hogs or a man withholding a can opener from his daughter on Twitter for beans. We will explain these things to you. You will be the most well-equipped person at your cocktail party to discuss what's going on online on any given week if you listen to our show.
Rachel, what do you think a lot of people might miss in their sort of daily scrolling that you hope to really dig into and explore in the show?
I mean, I think the thing about daily scrolling is that you kind of just see these internet phenomena divorced from their original context. Yeah. So you're just like, oh, something random's happening, something, another random thing is happening. But I think what ICY might give is context for a lot of these things. I think so often we see internet ephemera as just like it just bubbled up from nowhere. And very often there is a rich and somewhat dark history involved with why this thing is happening. And I think that that's what the show gives is just like, this isn't actually random. We could have seen this coming.
Yeah.
We did.
Connecting the dots.
And yeah. If you can give us a little sneak peek, what's the biggest, hottest thing right now on the internet? That's for either of you.
Our show this weekend is about the NCAA, which is the governing body for college sports in the United States, just allowed college athletes to start making money as influencers. So get ready for a whole lot of college basketball stars selling stuff on Instagram.
Ah, I love it. You're going for the Benjamins. I love this. Hey, Rachel and Madison, thank you both for joining us today. It has been a blast. We want to remind you, wherever you are, we have got our social media channels. We love to engage with you long after the show is over. We have our podcast as well. Thank you so much. Have a great time, everybody. See you next time here on The Social.
Subscribe to The Social Podcast so you don't miss a fiery debate. Until next time, socialites.